time, we're going to commence by looking at the miracle which the Master performed in the curing of the youth who was an epileptic. It appears in three of the Gospels, so if I give you the quotations again so that we can compare the records. Matthew chapter 17, verses 14 to 21. Mark chapter 9, verses 14 to 29. And Luke chapter 9, verses 37 to 43. That's Matthew 17, verses 14 to 21. Mark 9, verses 14 to 29. And Luke 9, verse 37 to 43. And it follows on immediately with the Master coming down from the Mount of Transfiguration with his three disciples. Because whilst they were up there and all the things which we have considered took place, don't forget, nine of his disciples were still down in the town below. And that's what Mark chapter 9 wants us to consider. So let's commence this evening by coming to Mark chapter 9 and verse 14. He's come down the mount. He's chatted with the three disciples on the way down concerning Elijah, who was first to come. And in verse 14, when he came to his disciples, this is the other nine, he saw a great multitude about them and the scribes questioning with them. So there'd obviously been some sort of controversy, some sort of matter which had arisen, which the multitude, and particularly the scribes, were either apportioning blame or trying to obtain from the nine disciples what was happening. Now, in verse 16 of Mark chapter 9, the Master, obviously knowing the thoughts of everyone, he asked the scribes, "What question ye with them?" And the outcome of it was, there was this man who had brought his son, who had got a dumb spirit. It would appear that he was an epileptic by what happened later on. And had obviously brought this child, or this youth, or whatever age he was, to the nine disciples to say, "Can you cure him?" And for whatever reason, the nine disciples could not effect the cure. And no doubt the scribes were trying to, as we would use the expression, put the knife into them and sort of mock them and ridicule them, saying, "Well, you call yourself Jesus' disciples, you're not able to perform this simple task." Now, you've got to bear in mind Mark chapter 6. We've already thought about this before, that in verse 7 of Mark chapter 6, he called unto him the 12 and began to send them forth by two and two, and gave them power over unclean spirits. So presumably the disciples, the 12, had used this power on various occasions in order that they might reinforce the word that they were preaching. So if the scribes had come to us with somebody who was ill and say, "Right, cure him," then obviously we would have said, "No, don't be stupid, we haven't got the power, we haven't got the authority to do this." But the scribes had already acknowledged and seen that the nine disciples, with the other three previously, had had the power to be able to do this. And so they came to him without the Master and said, "Right, you know, effect a cure." And for whatever reason, and we'll look at that as we go through, the nine couldn't do it. So they were in disgrace. They were obviously very ashamed of the fact, again because of their comment later. And therefore, the scribes were the more trying to have a go at them. So we almost have a contrast between the Master in the Mount with the three disciples in glory, whilst down below, the other nine disciples were in disgrace. And it's almost reminiscent of Moses going up to the mount and the people down below falling into disrepute with the golden calf and other matters. But when we come back to Mark chapter 9, before the Master questions them, we find in verse 15, straightway all the people, when they beheld him, were greatly amazed and running to him, saluted him. Now, according to the gospel records, he'd not said anything then. All they saw was Jesus approaching. So why should they, in verse 15, be greatly amazed? Why should they run to him and salute him? And notice it says it was all the people, not just the 9 disciples. We could understand they, in this embarrassing situation, seeing Jesus coming and think, oh, at last, you know, someone's going to sort out the matter for us. But it was all the people who, seeing Jesus, when they beheld him, notice, were greatly amazed. And I would suggest that we have the same as we had with Moses. That the Shekinah glory, the glory of the God of Israel, shone in the face of Moses as he came down the mount, and so he did here with the Master. So we have almost the replica of Moses coming down the mount with the face shining with the reflected glory of God and the people in disgrace, and the Lord Jesus coming down in a very similar fashion. And that's the only way I can appreciate fully what verse 15 is saying, that the Master's face shone because of the glory of the transfiguration which had taken place only the day before. And obviously they couldn't understand what had happened. But before they could say anything, the Master says to them, why question ye with them? Notice, it's the scribes. It's not the people. He doesn't challenge the people. He challenges the scribes. It was they who were trying to ridicule the disciples. But you'll notice in verse 17, the scribes don't answer. It's the father of the child, one of the multitude, who provides an explanation. So obviously the scribes were now themselves in a very difficult, embarrassing situation. They thought they'd got the upper hand over the 9 disciples, but now the Master had returned, that was a different thing altogether. And so they were totally embarrassed by the questioning which the Master brought to them. Anyway, let's just carry on with the narrative. Verse 17, the father of this child says, Master, I have brought unto thee my son. Again, we can easily read it, and sometimes we can just pass it over. He hadn't brought unto Jesus his son. He brought it unto his disciples, because the Master wasn't there. So no doubt he had gone seeking Jesus, but he wasn't there. The 9 were, so he brought it unto them as representative of their Master. But that to the father, who was in a desperate situation, was as good as bringing it to Jesus. I've brought unto thee my son, who hath a dumb spirit. And wheresoever he taketh him, he teareth him, and he foameth and gnasheth with his teeth and pineth away. And I spake to thy disciples that they should cast him out, and notice, and they could not. Again, I don't think I'm reading into it that verse 18 implies they tried. They didn't say, no, we can't do miracles. It's impossible for us to be expected to do this. He said, I brought it to thy disciples, ask them to cast it, this devil out, but they could not. As if they had tried, and maybe tried and tried and tried and tried, but it hadn't happened. Go back to 2 Kings chapter 4. Whether or not you feel there is a suitable connection here, but to my mind there was a reasonable, a similar incident back in the days of Elisha. You remember that wonderful woman of Shunem who had shown great hospitality to Elisha? She'd never requested anything from him, but he said, look, whatever you want, I'll provide. And the son was provided for her, and then because of what happened, the son died, and this woman goes off to see the great prophet. Then we find in verse 29 of 2 Kings 4 that Elisha said to Gehazi, who was obviously his servant, get up thy loins and take my staff in thine hand and go thy way. If thou meet any man, salute him not. And if any salute thee, answer him not again, and lay my staff upon the child. And verse 31, and Gehazi passed on before them, and laid the staff upon the face of the child, but there was neither voice nor hearing. Wherefore he went again to meet him, and told him, saying, the child is not awake. Now, Gehazi obviously could not effect the cure. Now, against the background of 2 Kings 4, there was a very good reason that Elisha personally had to be there, but we'll leave that for a moment. The principle I wanted to sort of think as far as a connection is concerned, that here was the servant of Elisha who likewise could not effect a cure, and yet the way that Elisha spoke to him and the way that the servant went, he expected to do so, but he couldn't. And I would suggest the disciples likewise thought they could do the cure, but they couldn't. So when we come back to Mark chapter 9, verse 19, Jesus answered him and said, O faithless generation, how long shall I be with you? How long shall I suffer you? Bring him unto me. Now I wonder whether or not the master was basically speaking to the 9 disciples, or whether he was speaking to the multitude as a whole, representing the people of Israel. Just think about it for a second. We've got one or two similar quotations elsewhere in the scriptures which might help us. Can we go back to Numbers 32? Not Numbers, Deuteronomy 32. And similar words to verse 19 are used right back in the book of Deuteronomy, chapter 32. Look at verse 5. They have corrupted themselves, their spot is not the spot of his children. They are a perverse and crooked generation. Look at verse 20. I will hide my face from them. I will see what their end shall be, for they are a very froward generation, children in whom is no faith. Now he was going to later on remind the disciples of their lack of faith was the reason they couldn't effect the cure. But he's saying to Israel at the time of Deuteronomy 32 that Israel were a very froward generation, children in whom is no faith. If you go forward to the Acts of the Apostles, chapter 2, the Apostle Peter on the day of Pentecost speaks in very similar words. Look at verse 40, you know Acts 2 very well. Acts 2 verse 40, and with many other words did he testify and exhort, saying, save yourselves from this untoward generation. Now it would seem in the context of Act 2 that Peter is talking about those 3,000 who were to respond, who were Jews, to save themselves from the untoward generation, which was the Jewish nation who had rejected their Messiah. Verse 36, let all the house of Israel know assuredly that God hath made that same Jesus whom you have crucified both Lord and Christ. So the response was, what have we got to do? And Peter is saying, save yourself from this untoward generation. So he links the perverse and crooked generation with the people of Israel at that time. Now when we come to Philippians, again we have similar words used by the Apostle Paul. And verse 15, Philippians 2 verse 15, you may be blameless and harmless, the sons of God, without rebuke, in the midst of a crooked and perverse nation, among whom ye shine as lights in the world. Now, was Paul here in verse 15 meaning the nation of Israel? Was he meaning the Gentile nation? Was he meaning Philippi itself, of which they had come out of the residents of Philippi, or was he speaking about those who are corrupt within the truth? I suppose there is implications for all of that. So it's not an uncommon expression in the scriptures. So when we come back to Mark chapter 9, was the master referring to the faithless generations as those of Israel, or was he being more narrow to say, you disciples, who should have been the children, the generation of faith, how long shall I be with you? How long shall I suffer you? You can do, why couldn't you do it? Because you're a faithless generation. Or was he applying it to the people as the nation as a whole? Leave that for you to think about. Let's go to verse 20. They brought unto him the child, and when he saw him, straightway the spirit tear him, and fell on the ground, and wallowed, foaming. And he asked his father, how long is it ago since this came unto him? And he says, of a child. And oft times it hath cast him into the fire, and into the waters to destroy him. But if thou canst do anything, have compassion, notice, on us, and help us. Now I would suggest there he's talking about himself and the child, or the son. Have compassion on both of us. It's obviously very distressing for him, it's also very distressing for me. And obviously for anyone who's witnessed an epileptic fit, we know how serious it can be. And during the time when these fits had occurred, it obviously caused him some damage, because it had cast him into the fire and into the waters, as if almost he was in a state of drowning at certain points. And the father was in a desperate situation. And notice, if thou canst do anything, please do it. And notice Jesus' response. Jesus said unto him, if thou canst. So look at the verse 22. But if thou canst, and the master says, if thou canst. So almost he's turning the whole situation round upon the father. If you can believe, I can help you. But if you don't think I can, then it won't happen. If thou canst believe, all things are possible. But if you can't, be it unto you according to your faith. And therefore the master was saying in no uncertain terms that the healing of this person depends totally upon your faith. If you can believe I can do it, then it's possible. If not, then it won't happen. And we know the wonderful response of the father in verse 24. And straightway the father of the child cried out and said with tears, Lord, I believe, help thou my unbelief. It's almost as if the father, if I can use the term, had got a half faith at this moment in time. He desperately wanted to believe, and therefore he didn't feel adequate. He didn't feel that his faith was probably strong enough to answer the master correctly. And therefore there was no question that he believed, but if it wasn't sufficient, Lord, please help me. And just as an aside for a moment, I think we all feel like that at times. We have faith. We believe. But there are times when we don't think our belief, our faith is strong enough, and therefore we go to God in prayer to help our belief. I don't think that's wrong at all. I think on the contrary, it's what the Father desires to hear from us. I think there's an implication of even Abraham in this. Come back to Genesis 15. If we do use the Apostle Paul's comment in Romans 4, the true testimony of Abraham's faith was that he believed in God and he counted it to him for righteousness. And that's in response to the fact that God had promised him this seed. Verse 5, Genesis 15, He brought him forth abroad, and said, Look now toward heaven, and tell the stars, if thou be able to number them. And he said unto him, So shall thy seed be. And Abraham believed in the Lord, and he counted to him for righteousness. And that's what Paul picks up in Romans 4, as we know. So here was, we would assume, Abraham at the pinnacle of his faith. This was a man who had got no question of his total belief and commitment to what he had heard. And yet then in verse 8, Abraham said, Lord God, whereby shall I know that I shall inherit it? And that faith again had to be strengthened and underlined by Abraham going into the deep sleep and all the rest of the things of Genesis 15. And so that's why it was only when his faith was strengthened and strengthened and strengthened that Genesis 22 comes along and his faith could be put to the utmost test. Genesis 15 would seem to underline that at this moment in time, I know Isaac wasn't born, but he wouldn't have been sufficiently strong enough to have carried out what Genesis 22 required of him. So his faith had to be increased. And I believe, God willing, that's what occurs with ourselves. We go through life, our faith is constantly added to. It's not a question that we've got all sufficient faith from day one or even day two. It's a constant, Lord, I believe, but help thou my unbelief. So coming back to Mark chapter 9, in verse 25, when Jesus saw the people came running together, the implication, they were running towards him and the Father. So again, by almost default of what verse 25 says, he must have taken the Father on one side. Therefore, the discussion which we've just looked at between Jesus and the Father was not in the ears of the people. And the people were obviously wondering what was going on. Nothing seemed to be happening. Was Jesus not able also to perform this miracle? And so, perhaps being restrained to a degree by the disciples, they now were running towards Jesus. And so he rebuked the foul spirit, saying, Thou dumb and deaf spirit, I charge thee, come out of him, and enter no more into him. So don't forget, not only was he epileptic, but he was also dumb and deaf. But then notice, in verse 26, after Jesus had said these words, the spirit came, the spirit cried and rent him sore, and came out of him, and he was as one dead, insomuch that many said, He is dead. Now if Jesus in verse 25 had spoken the words to the child to be cured, why does 26 happen? Did Jesus' power fail him for a while? Did he take a period of time to work on the child? Of course not. One word from the master would have been all sufficient. The child could have been running about again, no problem whatsoever. But verse 26 says that he had one last fit so bad, so sore, that many thought he was dead. So why did that happen? I believe because of verse 23. Jesus had said to this man, if you can believe, everything is possible. Don't doubt. I will increase, I will enhance your faith, but trust me, have no doubt whatsoever, I am going to effect the cure of this child. And then suddenly, the child appears to be dead. And I believe that was the test of the faith of this man, as it was of Abraham's faith. Because faith without works is dead. It's one thing saying, Lord, I believe. And then something happens and that shatters us. Things are tried and tested in our lives to see whether we have got that total commitment, that total belief in him, after praying that he will help us and enhance that faith. And it would seem, I would suggest on the basis of verse 27, that the man's faith didn't falter. That Jesus took him by the hand lifted him up, and he arose. I can imagine the scribes mocking. Yeah, he can't cure it any more than his disciple. You think he's the Messiah? What a load of nonsense. The child's dead. Just shows what words from him will do to anybody. And yet I believe amongst that the faith of the Father never hesitated. And therefore, be it unto thee according to thy faith. If thou canst believe, all things are possible to him that believeth. And the child, as it were, in a figure, was risen from the dead. I don't believe he actually died, but using the same analogy of Isaac, the master took him up. Now, when in verse 28 he was coming to the house, his disciples asked him privately, why could we not cast him out? Again, although we're not told, it would seem it was the house of the Father. He obviously wanted to thank the Master. He wanted to put on a feast. He wanted to, you know, express his gratitude and his appreciation for what he was done. We can imagine the overwhelming feeling of this Father for the Master and what he had done. And whilst no doubt the food was being prepared and all the other things, Jesus and his disciples were there together privately. And you can imagine what was in the mind of the disciples. Why couldn't we do that? Now, before we go to verse 29, let's look at Matthew 17. Because Matthew puts something which neither Mark nor Luke puts in. Verse 19, to get the context, Matthew 17. Then came the disciples to Jesus apart and said, why could not we cast him out? And the Master replies to them, because of your unbelief, for verily I say unto you, if you have faith as a grain of mustard seed, ye shall say unto this mountain, remove hence to yonder place, and it shall remove, and nothing shall be impossible to you. A few comments I'd like to make. First of all, Lord, why couldn't we do it? Answer in verse 20, because of your unbelief. Think back to Mark chapter 9, verse 23. If you will believe, all things are possible to him that believeth. The disciples genuinely didn't believe they could cure this man. He says it was because of your unbelief. Same principle as Gehazi back in 2 Kings chapter 4. You lacked the commitment, you lacked the belief that you could do it. When you tried and nothing happened, your faith failed you. And therefore he says, if you have faith as a grain of mustard seed, ye shall say unto this mountain, remove hence to yonder place, and it shall remove, and nothing shall be impossible unto you. Howbeit, this kind goeth not out by prayer and fasting. What did the Master mean? If you have the faith as a grain of mustard seed, a grain of mustard seed is used in another context as being the smallest of all seeds. So you have to have the smallest faith possible, then you shall say unto this mountain, remove hence, and it will happen. Well, was he trying to rebuke the disciples because he said, you've got no faith at all? You haven't even got the faith of a grain of mustard seed. And yet we know in reality, verse 20, if we took it literally, doesn't happen. If you come to 1 Corinthians chapter 13, where the Apostle Paul is speaking about the virtues of love, he prefaces his remarks by saying, as we know, and we could almost recite the words in verse 1, though I speak with the tongues of men and of angels and have not love, I am become as a sounding brass or a tinkling cymbal. And though I have the gift of prophecy and understand all mysteries and all knowledge, and though I have all faith so that I could remove mountains and have not love, I am nothing. Now, did the apostle literally mean mountains in the sense of a Mount Snowdon or a Mount of Olives or a Mount Hermon or whatever? Did he literally mean that? Or was he saying, basically, there is no obstacle, no burden, no mountain that we have to carry, no obstacle which can get in our way, which is too great to overcome to a man of faith? Now, I would suggest he meant the latter. I don't think he was literally talking about mountains. I think he meant the mountains which beset us, the problems, the difficulties, the burdens, the obstacles, which are in our way day by day as far as the truth is concerned. And he says you might have sufficient faith to be able to overcome all of those problems. But if you haven't got love, you're nothing. So faith on its own is not acceptable to God. That's what the 13th chapter is about. But think about it first in this context, what we're trying with the master's comment to the disciples. He's saying faith can remove mountains. So coming back to Matthew 17 and verse 20. If you have faith as a grain of mustard seed, you shall say unto this mountain, remove hence to yonder place, and it shall remove, and nothing shall be impossible to you. And he makes the comment, howbeit this kind of faith goeth not out but by prayer and fasting. Now most translations leave out the word fasting. Virtually every other translation puts prayer on its own. The Revised Version, the Diaglot, the Revised Standard Version, the Jerusalem Bible, the New International Version, etc., 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 simply put in, howbeit this kind goeth not out but by prayer. As if the Master didn't say at all, fasting. And I would suggest that is a fact in view of what he said in verse 20. Because he's talking about this removing of mountains by faith. And this comes out through prayer. Now again, brothers and sisters, the Master was to repeat almost a very similar comment when we go to Mark's Gospel again and chapter 11. We're now in the last week of the Lord's life. It was the 11th day of the month Abib, the day before he had ridden triumphantly into Jerusalem. And then on the 11th day, coming from Bethany, he was hungry, sees a fig tree without figs, and he curses it. And the disciples, the very next day, on the 12th day, saw that the fig tree had been cursed, and they couldn't understand what had happened. And so in verse 23, the Master says, verily I say unto you, that whosoever shall say unto this mountain, be thou removed, and be thou cast into the sea, and shall not doubt in his heart, but shall believe that these things which he saith shall come to pass, he shall have whatsoever he saith. So again, in the context, the Master is saying to them again, if you'll say to this mountain, be thou cast into the sea, it will happen. Which is almost identical language to the ones he uses in Matthew 17. And again, both in Matthew 17 and here in Mark chapter 11, I don't believe he's talking of a literal mountain, but of a symbolic one of the mountains of problems and sin and all the other things which beset us. Now I'd like to, for a few moments, look at Mark 11 verse 23 so that we can prove this. And I say that advisedly. We'll have a look at some scriptural quotations which I believe underline what we're saying. Look at verse 1 of Mark chapter 11. When they came nigh to Jerusalem, unto Bethpage and Bethany at the Mount of Olives, he sendeth forth two of his disciples. So to walk from Bethany via Bethpage to the Mount of Olives to Jerusalem. So they had left Bethany, they'd come to Bethpage to the Mount of Olives to Jerusalem. That was the route they took on the 3 days which are mentioned here in Mark chapter 11. Now, as you are probably aware, but we'll sort of mention it anyway, the word Bethphage, or the name Bethphage, means the house of unripe figs. Whereas Bethany means the house of dates, and don't forget it was palm leaves they threw in the way before the master, so the palm leaves came from the dates for which Bethany was well known. It was the house of dates. Bethphage, which is closer to the Mount of Olives than Bethany, was the house of unripe figs. So again, Josephus tells us there were fig trees there in the days of the master. So it was not unusual to find fig trees in the way. But the figs were not ripe, hence the cursing of the fig tree, which was symbolic of the nation of Israel. But right in front of them, as they were walking from Bethphage, was the Mount of Olives. Now when we come back to the first book of Kings in chapter 11, scripturally, we've got to understand what the Mount of Olives represented to the Jews of that day. In the first of Kings chapter 11, it gives us account of the sorry state that Solomon got himself in when he married all those women whose heart turned him away, who turned away his heart to serve their gods. And to try and placate his wives, Solomon built all these idols to the various gods and goddesses. And in verse 7 of 1 Kings 11, then did Solomon build an high place for Chemosh, the abomination of Moab, in the hill that is before Jerusalem. Now he doesn't tell us there what that hill is, but if you look in your margin, 2 Kings 23 verse 13, and just go over there, it will tell you what that hill is. 2 Kings 23, and it won't surprise you to know that that hill was the Mount of Olives. It was the hill that is before Jerusalem on the east. But 2 Kings chapter 23 and verse 13, we're now in the time of Josiah when he was to break down and rip away all those idols that Solomon had built up. So he brought the Reformation to Israel, or to Judah I should say. But in verse 13 of 2 Kings 23, and the high places that were before Jerusalem, which were on the right hand of the Mount of Corruption, which Solomon the king of Israel had builded, and by the phrase of the Mount of Corruption, in your central margin, you'll see that it says the Mount of Olives. So the hill that was before Jerusalem was the Mount of Olives, which was named by the Jews as the Mount of Corruption. So the Mount of Corruption was the Mount of Olives. The Mount of Glory was the Mount of Zion. And so to the Jew, Olivet was synonymous with idolatry, with sin, with wickedness, with corruption. Zion was synonymous with glory, with the city of the great king, with the kingdom. So as we today say the Thames is synonymous of London, or the Seine with Paris, etc., etc., so in their day, Olivet was synonymous with sin, with wickedness, and with corruption. So when the master says, look, why is the fig tree cursed? Why was Israel cursed? Because they didn't bring forth fruit. Why didn't they bring forth fruit? Because they were bogged down with their own sin, with their own idolatry, with their own wickedness, with their own corruption. And because of that, the people, the fig tree, became synonymous with the Mount of Olives, and it's got to remove. Before anybody can bring forth fruit to God, everything which is a burden, which is an obstacle to them, has got to be got rid of. Now when we go therefore to Micah's prophecy, and Micah chapter 7, I believe the prophet Micah gives us the understanding of what the master is saying, because I believe the master is actually expounding Micah chapter 7. Micah chapter 7, look at verse 18. Words are well known to us, but think of it now in the context of what the master is saying about the cursing of the fig tree. Who is a God like unto thee that pardoneth iniquity, passeth by the transgression of the remnant of his heritage? He retaineth not his anger forever, because he delighteth in mercy. He will turn again, he will have a compassion upon us. He will subdue our iniquities, and thou wilt cast all their sins into the depths of the sea. thou wilt perform the truth to Jacob and the mercy to Abraham. What was he casting into the sea? Look at Mark chapter 11 and verse 23. But if you say unto this mountain, be thou cast into the sea, and have no doubt in your heart that this will happen, it will happen. So he's not looking at Olivet in the sense of Zechariah 14 or anything of that nonsense. He's looking at the Mount of Olives as representative of the mountain of sin and iniquity and corruption which bear down upon us and stops us producing that fruit to the glory of God. And he says, but if you have no doubt in your mind that he can be cast into the sea and be removed from you, then it will happen. And so in verse 22 of Mark 11 he says, have faith in God. Believe that God is able and willing to do this for you, and it will happen. But in verse 25 of Mark 11, when you stand praying for what? For the mountain of sin and iniquity to be removed. When you stand praying, forgive. Because if you're not willing to forgive your brother their trespasses, neither will your Father forgive you your trespasses. So that mountain of sin and corruption will never be removed, and you'll never bring forth fruit to the glory of God. And therefore, don't doubt in your heart that God can do it, but have no doubt in your heart also about forgiving your brother their trespasses. So when we come back now to Matthew chapter 17, I believe that the Master is using the same analogy as he is used there in Mark chapter 11. Quoted Mark 11 because we might understand it a bit easier. Why couldn't the disciples cure that man or that child of his sin and iniquity, of the deaf and dumb spirit? Why couldn't he remove iniquity from that child? Because they lacked faith. That's what he says. You haven't got sufficient belief. If only you believed in God, and you would say unto him, remove it from the hens to yonder place. What's the yonder place? Cast it into the sea. We have a God, brothers and sisters and young people, who not only forgives our iniquities, but forgets it. We might be willing to forgive, we don't always forget. And that's the saddest indictment against us. We've got a God who, as it were, will throw it into the sea, and it's washed away, never to be remembered or seen again. That's what he's willing to do to our sin and iniquity. Providing we have faith in God. And therefore, he says, this kind goeth not out but by prayer. Lord, teach us to pray. Our Father, which art in heaven, forgive us our trespasses as we forgive those that trespass against us. If we don't believe that, if we haven't got faith to believe that he will, and we doubt in our heart, it won't happen. And that's what the Master is saying time and time and time and time again. And that's why he rebuked his disciples. Not that he's expecting us in these days to be able to perform miracles. Not that he's expecting us to be able to literally say to a mountain, be rather removed. But what he is saying, that we have the ability and we have the right through faith for the sin, the iniquity, the mountains, the burdens, the problems which beset us will be removed if we are willing also to remove them when others trespass against us. This kind goeth not out but by prayer. And it was a message and a lesson the disciples had to understand. And I would say the 20th century disciples likewise have to understand it. It's a vital part of our message of salvation to each and every one. You notice then we come on to the next section. But I believe that the whole of this, brothers and sisters, is a parable of Israel. I believe that the curing of the lunatic was very similar to the fig tree being cursed. Israel were in this lunatic state. They obviously were admonished, punished for the things they had done. Help and cure was at hand if only they would seek it. But they had to have that faith which the father possessed in order for the cure to be effected. Sadly, very few in Israel had that utter belief of the father that his child would be cured. Hence, because the sin and the iniquity could not be removed from their lives, they couldn't bring forth the fruit. And I don't want to elaborate it, because we shall look at it a bit later on in our studies when we come to a very similar incident where I'd like to develop the parable of Israel more. Can we just move on, because I'd like to try and do a bit more tonight. Can you just have a look at the next section? Again, the three Gospels mention it. It's Matthew 17, verse 22 to 23, Mark chapter 9, verse 30 to 32, and Luke chapter 9, verses 43 to 45. Matthew 17, 22 to 23, Mark 9, 30 to 32, Luke 9, 43 to 45. Whilst we're still in Matthew, let's just read what it says. Verse 22, while they abode in Galilee, Jesus said unto them, the Son of Man shall be betrayed into the hands of men, they shall kill him, the third day he shall be raised again. And they were exceeding sorry. Can we just go to Mark's account, Mark chapter 9. Verse 13 and 31 of Mark chapter 9 basically says the same thing, but in verse 32, but they understood not that saying and were afraid to ask of him. Now, in one sense, it's almost hard to believe that comment. The whole purpose of the transfiguration had been to impress upon the minds of the disciples that the Lord must go into Jerusalem, suffer many things of the elders and chief priests and scribes, be killed and be raised again the third day. That's what he'd begun to explain to them, and Peter said, no, Lord, no, it's not going to be that way. And the very principle we've seen of the transfiguration was pictorial to represent the sufferings and the glory. He then came to reinforce this by word again and said, look, this is what's going to happen. And they still did not understand. So again, brothers and sisters, was it because the disciples could not accept still at this point that he truly was the Messiah of Israel, that they had not been able to cure that lunatic? Albeit they hadn't got faith, but was it because their mind was not right before him? That they were still in this state of perplexedness where, you know, we don't quite fit it all in, we're not absolutely sure. That they still were not walking in step with their master. Because again, when he says, what's going to happen? They still couldn't believe it. They didn't understand those things which were written. And again, we think about that from our point of view, of whether or not we have similar concerns at times. But I'd like to move on, because I'd like to set the scene for the next thing, what's going to happen. And that is contained only in Matthew. Now this is easier to appreciate. It's only in Matthew chapter 17, verse 24 to 27. They were still in the region of Galilee, but verse 24 tells us they came specifically to Capernaum. Now we know Capernaum had become the hometown. We know that it was the house of Peter, and perhaps the master was residing with Peter at this point in time, and it was on the seashore. And when they were come to Capernaum, in verse 24, they that received tribute money came to Peter and said, doth not your master pay tribute? And Peter, without question, says, of course he does, yes. But when he was coming to the house, Jesus prevented him, saying, what thinkest thou, Simon? Again, reading his mind, of whom do the kings of the earth take custom or tribute, of their own children or of strangers? Peter said unto him, of strangers. Jesus said unto him, then are the children free. Notwithstanding, lest we should offend them, go to the sea, cast an hook, and take up the fish that first cometh up. And when thou hast opened his mouth, thou shalt find a piece of money, that take, and give it unto them for me and for thee. Now it would seem, brothers and sisters, that verse 24 onwards is just an isolated incident. But there doesn't seem to be any reason, apart from a miracle was performed, as to why it should be in this context. I believe it's because of what's gone on. I believe the master wanted to almost pick up Peter again and say, Peter, don't you still understand who I am and what I'm teaching you? And I believe the master went through this situation with Peter to try and reinforce the lesson of verses 22 and 23 and of Matthew chapter 16 verse 21 and of the very fact of the transfiguration of the sufferings and glory. And what I'd like to do next time, God willing, is pick this up, because I think we will see an incredible, I was quite moved with it, I can only say that, when we considered it, of the tremendous lesson that was there for Peter, and maybe for us as well.